All right, well, good to have everybody here tonight. If you weren't here Sunday to get Lesson 13 is there. There's a stack that has the answers for Lesson 13, and there should be a stack there for you to turn in kind of your results. So if for some reason you're not to that point that you want to turn it in, just, you know, Sunday or whatever, you leave it in the computer room or something there, and I'll find it. So tonight's the review, and I have tried to challenge y'all a good bit, burn up a few brain cells, and so actually what we're going to do tonight, if I'm successful, is we're going to go through all 12 lessons. So. I am ambitious, and it gets me in trouble. So anyway, we are at the end of our class. We have, you know, we study here, but we really just sort of skip over where the world makes this radical curve. And so that's what's been the focus of this class, and I think we've all learned. So put in the right order. I think it was only someone that was questioning my orders, and that can be understandable. So if you haven't finished the test or whatever, cover your ears or your eyes at least. Okay. So, and again, blame Martin for any of these because this is his thing. So Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, right? Everyone got that one? All right. Then Cyrus defeats Babylon. And then you have the Feast of the Lights dedication, so you're in that period of the Persian period. So you kind of know Cyrus is a Persian, so you defeat that. So you're in this time period here. Then Athens gets defeated by Macedonia, because that occurs after the Persian Wars, right? After Xerxes and Darius go in there and try to take over Greece, and they fail. Then the Greeks get real proud and really huffy, and the Athenians and all that mess. But then the Macedonians kind of come along and actually take Athens after they've fought all over the Peloponnesian War and stuff. Death of Alexander the Great. So that was kind of cruel of me, right, not to say Alexander the Great goes conquers everything. But that would be kind of the next order. So if you're going to have one of the two, we kind of put that there. And then Antiochus defeated by the Maccabees. And then Rome defeats Carthage. And then I have Rome defeats the Macedonians. So, and there was actually kind of several things here, but I think that's kind of the order I had. Are y'all pretty well in agreement with that? Is there some disagreement?
I'm confused. And what is the Feast of Lights and dedication celebrating?
That's Esther, the saving of... No,
that's Purim. You're thinking of Purim.
That's Purim. You're right. Hanukkah is the Maccabees. Yeah. You're correct. I got them mixed up.
I asked my Jewish wife. She knew.
You are correct. All right. So that one, Esther, actually Esther's wrong. I got those, yes. So that is, that would go, defeated by the Maccabees. So that one would be next. That would be 7. And Esther, mark out. So anyway. And Martin did not make that mistake. That one was my mistake. All right. Yeah, it would go.
Start with one.
How about if we just cross out Feast of Lights dedication and just put Esther?
then it's right. Yeah. That's right. So forget everything. It's Esther. How about that? We'll put Esther and I get it right. So it's supposed to be Esther. There. Thank you, Marty. That's the right solution. All right. So it's Esther.
Is that still three?
If you say Esther,
yeah.
If you keep Esther, you're good, or I'm good, or I'm saved, or redeemed. Okay. Then Pompey conquers Jerusalem. Octavian defeats Anthony at Actium, and the crucifixion of Christ, and then the destruction of the Jerusalem by Romans. So if we mark out and keep that to Esther, and y'all didn't get too confused with my mistake there, how did we do? Okay?
All right.
Good.
The problem with an order thing, if you missed one, you probably missed three or four.
Yeah.
By slipping down, you know.
Yeah. So we won't count anything off there. So you got pretty good order there. We'll work out. We'll figure out. We'll try to count the Chads and get you in good shape. Okay. So fullness of time, class number one, right? Kind of when we started, that we look at the Old Testament, worshiping in the temple. New Testament, a lot more on the synagogue. The teachers in the Old Testament, priests. In the New Testament, the scribes. Jerusalem. Actually, all the cities around that area in ruins. We come to the New Testament, densely populated. Factions. You could have kind of put something here, but there's no way that the factions at this time period, at the close of the Old Testament, matches the differences of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, the Essenes. Politically, self-rule, Roman rule. Language, Hebrew-Aramaic. New Testament, Aramaic or Greek. The southern kingdom, or Judea. Here we have Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. Worldview of the Old Testament, it's kind of that Eastern. Kings, Persian, laws of the Medes and the Persians. Western thought, kind of Roman law. So a very different world. That's kind of how we started the class. The other thing that we kind of went through is we kind of alluded here to Daniel. And what we have is kind of, I alluded to this, and so I figured I needed to kind of get it in here before we ended the class. Nothing like doing new material on a review. So when you do prophecies, kind of immediately, within a short time period, medium range, within the lifetime of the prophet, long range, prophet's dead, get a good 100 years or so afterwards. Messianic prophecies tend to be that great time span, or something, day coming, offering hope for a better day. So when we come to Daniel 2, we have that head of gold, that's Nebuchadnezzar. So that is right there in that short range. That is like today, Nebuchadnezzar rules. Another kingdom inferior, the Persians, that's going to occur right towards the end of Daniel's life. The long range, we get the third kingdom, which is the Greeks. We then get the Romans, and, if you look at the Bible, 70, 90 A.D., you look at kind of how long the Roman Empire lasted, 746, 300. So anyway, kind of that time period. But again, Daniel's talking about all of this back at this period here. So we're good, some 600 years before Christ. And so then there is that prophecy that in the days of the fourth kingdom, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. And so there you get your messianic. So kind of a prophecy that we all kind of know, and actually we spend a good bit of this class working our way through Daniel 2 because he lists out the kingdoms that are going to be coming. So during the Babylonian time, we have the start of all of this. We have the Jewish dispersion, the synagogue worship, the Messiah promise, crucifixion. So just to really get myself in trouble and to really see if we can get this done in the allotted time, what is something kind of, the question we kind of had is that you're going to be talking to people, or you have an opportunity to talk to people, or in the class that this helped kind of encourage you. The Jewish dispersion, how did that have, why was that a critical thing for the fullness of time?
There were people that knew the Hebrew scriptures throughout the land.
Throughout the land. They were all dispersed. So I remember, I've always heard of Jews. I knew the Jewish people lived in our country. You see pictures and stuff of them. But you know, I never really seen a Orthodox Jew until I worked up in New York. So, you know, I actually saw them. So here, that these synagogues were all of these communities. So as the gospel is going and being spread out, this concept that God has a plan, that there's a fulfillment, that there's this Messiah coming, that the whole thing about God's message, it's been spread out. And then also, what does Paul do when he does his modus operandi or whatever? What's the first thing that he does when he comes into a new town? Goes to synagogues. He's got there. I mean, when we're trying to get a congregation started somewhere, what's important is to have that first nucleus, right? So those synagogues spread around. There were people there that were going to listen to that message so that there was that nucleus, that place to get started, to get Christians established all across the Roman Empire. Synagogue worship, kind of what, I already answered that one, sort of, didn't I? In the dispersion, okay. Messiah promised, okay. Why is that important to the fullness of time?
We could see how God was working out and was in control.
Yes.
All the way through. He's keeping his promise.
Right.
We see how it was fulfilled.
And to your earlier point, there were people who read the prophecies and knew that this was when the Messiah was supposed to come. And even if they had a slightly wrong view of what the kingdom and the Messiah were going to be, they at least were looking for it so that when he came, they were ready.
Yeah, and that's a very good point there to bring out, that the people were ready. They knew, you know, just, you know, you could have thought back in 100 B.C., they could have thought, you know, hey, listen, you know, the Romans are here. That's the fourth kingdom. Where's the Messiah coming? So it is that anticipation. All right?
And the other idea maybe too is in captivity. And I assume these are having to do with Babylon.
Yes.
So you have this sense of things are destroyed and they must be restored. So that expectation then begins that has God abandoned his people? What about the promises to David? All the things that, you know, kind of really were the foundation of the Messianic hope.
And there's that hope, and that gives you hope then to go back into the land. And all. Crucifixion. Now, the crucifixion here isn't the level or the kind of crucifixion that we're familiar with, but it kind of gets its start there. So, what is important in the development of crucifixion?
Prophecy, because
the
Jewish law said
stone. Yeah. Plus, I mean, it is about the cruelest way that you can kill somebody. Okay, so now we get to lesson, chapter 3, pretty good for me. Oh yeah, that's right, 3. Persians. All right, so Persian, the empire there, we really don't really see a whole lot of impact of Persia by the time we get to the time of Christ. But, you know, it spread that Eastern culture, kind of got it set up. They had some road network, nothing like what the Romans had, the Aramaic language. We capture that with Christ on the cross. Further dispersion, and in fact, you pretty much look at a good majority of the people from the day of Pentecost that is in this region of where the Persians were. I mean, it's all in that Persian area, so they continue. There's some that say kind of that's when the Sanhedrin got started, or at least the elements or the concept of the Sanhedrin, and it actually gave a nation for the Greeks to conquer. That, you know, that's kind of the borders they conquered. They conquered Persia. So if you didn't have a Persian empire, you wouldn't have the borders for which the Greek were going to go out and conquer there. Another thing is we jump back. We even go further back than Daniel. We go to Isaiah. And he says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them." So this is 740, 700 B.C. We're 539. Long range there. And then you have also laid out there the prophecy against Babylon. And we come to the days of John, to the book of Revelation, and there's still people living in Babylon. But, I mean, it is not the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's days. I mean, it is a city mostly in ruins, you know, just kind of the walls. There are some things there. And so when John talks about Rome and alludes to it as Babylon, I mean, people could think, well, you know, Rome, I mean, you really get that impression, right, how strong Rome is and powerful. So just imagine people reading the book of Revelation and John making that allusion, that comparison, that connection to Babylon, which is a city that is just a ghost town. And so that, to me, would bring mind to those that that read Isaiah, kind of that nice connection there. So more Jewish dispersion, more synagogue worship going on, the Messiah promised, the Sanhedrin, crucifixion, and we really, kind of with the Persians, we associate Ezra and Nehemiah, right? Coming back in, teaching those scribes. So kind of setting up the scribes as an important role of teaching the law. And then we get Alexander the Great, and comes in, just sweeps through the Persian Empire, and actually the high priest, when they're coming in, Alexander the Great is marching on Jerusalem. The high priest comes and shows Alexander the Great the prophecies in Daniel. And so Jerusalem is saved. Now, it's Josephus, so whether your opinion of Josephus, you can take that. But again, the people were reading this. They knew that they were living these days. You can imagine, I mean, you know, here you're living in this little backwater of Persia. And here comes Alexander the Great, conquer. And he's up there in Tyre, you know, laying siege to that, takes that. He's on his way to Egypt. He's coming through there. You're going to kind of be looking to see what God has to say, right? I mean, you know that Daniel kind of talks about this kind of silent period here. And so you're going to be reading this. And so you read that and you see what Alexander the Great does. You kind of understand, okay, this goat here, that's Alexander the Great coming through. And so there, Daniel 2, again, this period here, and here we're 331 kind of B.C. So, well, almost 300 years after that period there. And so, again, just the power of Daniel's prophecies there. And then also, just to throw in, because normally if you're studying Ezekiel, you might not stop and do this. But Ezekiel and the prophecy against Tyre, there's a short time period there where he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar leading siege and destroying the mainland. And then you have the long range where Alexander the Great comes in. And you have that description that was so powerful, just talking about the city is going to be scraped clean. When people destroy cities, they don't scrape it clean. So to make that kind of description. And then, you know, Alexander the Great says, well, I'm going to build a land bridge across there. And so he scrapes the ruins and stuff from the mainland Tyre into the ocean there. Very powerful prophecy there. So here we've got the Greeks. Again, Greek common language. How does that help in spreading the gospel? That's an easy one. I should have about five people trying to jump to answer that one. Everybody can understand the language. I mean, we're fortunate. English, the Brits took over and controlled so much of the world that English is a very common language. And then our culture and the U.S., people dealing with that and the effects of World War II. I mean, we see the power of a common language, but it was really, I mean, the Greek culture was the way to go, and thus you spoke Greek, and so that came in, that enabled the people. We have the Greek philosophy, the religion, which by the time of Christ, there was failures, there was inadequacies there, and so then we have those kind of added to our chart of fullness of time. Probably should have done that as an hour class or something, but anyway, we're working our chart here. So anyway, we're up to lesson 5. We get the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And so there the kingdom breaks up into 4 pieces. You have the city of Alexandria built, the very city that, you know, when Tyre was destroyed, kind of destroyed the shipping on this side of the world. And so Alexandria filled that in. The Septuagint is written. And then you have here Daniel 11. And so this is done, you know, kind of at, it talks about verse 1, Darius the Mede coming, the year of Cyrus. And then he jumps there in verse 2 and just lays out the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. I don't think there are many other chapters that you could turn to in the Bible where just you go verse by verse by verse and you just lay out the history and it's there. Those events. And so we asked ourselves, right? Why would God feel that it was important for that kind of level of prophecy? Why would that be important?
It's going to be times of great hardship, and that way they know it's not just happening that God has gone off somewhere and left them. God knew it was going to happen. He told them it was going to happen, and he told them that eventually it would get better.
Yeah. So, now, it didn't tell them, okay, this next guy is going to do this or that, whatever, but you look, he comes to power, you see these things starting to fold out. You look at Daniel 11, boy, God nailed it. And again, what are we talking about here? We're talking 300, 160 B.C. there, 600, 500. How could Daniel do that? How could Daniel have had that accuracy of Daniel 11? All right. So we then kind of narrowed in. I mean, we've been taking big chunks of time, but we stopped with Antiochus the Fourth. And why did we stop with Antiochus the Fourth?
He was such a special guy.
He was a special evil guy. And so there, you know, he's described, you know, he shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offerings and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. The temple's going to be desecrated. That, you know, yes, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids had been fighting back and forth, but Antiochus, such a Hellenist, he is going to have Jupiter worship in the temple there. And so here, you know, 160 B.C., you know, 600, 530 B.C. Kind of time period. And so with the Ptolemies, we add the Septuagint, and we really kind of have the beginnings of the Jewish sects there. So why is the Septuagint important? Why is it important for that to be in place when the Messiah comes? How did the Septuagint help?
Greek translation.
Greek translation. Yeah. How many of you here can read Hebrew? All right. How many of you can read Greek? All right. How many of you can read English? All right.
Not very well.
Not very well. Like I say, I have trouble. I'm Southern English. So it gave the Old Testament in a way that the people could read it. When you're teaching people, you want to open up the Bible. You want them to read it, right? What does the Bible say? It's not what I'm saying. It's what the Bible says. So as the gospel is being spread, it's important that the people can read. And so that, of course, links the common language there. Let's see. I'll go back. Okay, or is that supposed to be the Maccabees? Okay. All right, so we then get to the Maccabees, and so they revolt, right? There's a priest in this little small town that says, hold on a second, this isn't right. And so he leads a revolt. They end up conquering or keeping the Seleucids out. And remember, part of the reason that the Seleucids were being in such trouble was the Romans were on the other side of them, just chopping them off of them. Bit at a time. From the Maccabees, we bring in the Herod family. How did the Herod family get in there? What little place did the Maccabees kind of take off as they were rebuilding the old kingdom of David?
Idumea.
And so that's where Herod's from, his family. His dad kind of gets in that place of power. And so when the Maccabees kind of do that, they set in motion Herod the Great's family coming in. Roman ire. So military, they just, like I said, they just kept kind of chomping their way through and took over the whole Mediterranean. And that's how Daniel kind of describes it. And, you know, you get that feel because, you know, how many times kind of as we were reading through the history, like, it just, you know, hit me once more again. That here we're talking about Herod, you know, he comes with the Roman legions and the Arabians that are kind of sitting out there laying siege to Jerusalem. In march the Romans. The Arabians say, bye, we're leaving. And it just happened. I mean, Antiochus IV, one of the people, reason people say Antiochus IV just got really grumpy and all of that stuff was, he was going down there to take the Egypt. And the Roman guy comes up and says, no, Rome doesn't want you to do this. And Antiochus knew what Rome could do. So he turns around and marches off. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that is a reputation of an army. I mean, and again, it wasn't like they had machine guns taking on armed swords. It was this discipline that the Romans had. And so we come here to our fourth kingdom, and again, it's going to be in those days that the Messiah comes. And so with the Romans, we bring Roman peace. How does Roman peace help in spreading the gospel?
Makes it easier to travel.
Makes it easier to travel. Right? How many of you want to go visit Syria next week? Now, I have no desire to go to Syria next week. There's war going on there. So peace allows that. And it lasted for almost 200 years that there was peace. Pax Romana. Okay. They brought government and justice. And, you know, I think we can argue, well, Jesus was unjustly tried. But, you know, when we go through and we went through the New Testament, and it's really amazing, wasn't it, just how much we saw that interaction of the New Testament church of Jesus with Roman law and justice there. And so the Romans brought justice. They brought their form of government. The Hasmoneans also gave us, the Hasmoneans, we got the Jewish sects. So now here's a question. How in the world would having Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes help in the spread of the gospel?
That's what I was going to ask.
They
definitely protected the scriptures.
Yeah, with the Pharisees and, yeah. The scribes too. I mean, you know, when you're looking at, you know, the kind of how we got our Bible, I mean, Jewish scribes, it was impressive. They had several key steps in place to ensure the proper transcription. So definitely that kind of scribes as a group, very important.
So because of the multitude of Jewish sects, and the special provisions that the Romans made for the Jews because they were so ornery, the Christians were mistaken for a sect of the Jews for several years after the church was founded. So that gave them several years of kind of, you know,
protection.
Hazards.
Yeah. All right. Yes.
And because of their existence, Jesus set the scene for Jesus to teach all these wonderful lessons that we get from studying the Gospels, and Jesus dealt with all sorts of situations that involve these sects.
Yes. I mean, those are both, all of those are very good answers. Those are good answers, all right? They're giving better answers than I could have given you. Grady, did you have something to add there? Or?
I think that it was kind of a confluence of those different sects, including the Herodians and others, that brought about what would happen to bring Jesus to the cross. Because if it hadn't been for all those sects and the conflict that could have come up among them, the Romans would have said, who cares about this religious squabble? Just take care of it yourself. But when you dismiss or you bring about something that's going to cause a squabble and a problem, that's when the Romans get interested.
Yeah, so with the Pharisees, you had Jesus saying, well, you know, he's not following our traditional laws. And with the Sadducees saying, hold on, he's threatening our power. And if there's fussing here because of Jesus, we're in trouble. We'll lose our power. So having that divide, so two groups that would never really agree came to agree on the death of Jesus.
So in some ways, the Essenes, in their preservation of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they kind of serve our century in a way, you know, where at a time when there was this suspicion that the Catholics surely had, you know, altered the scripture all through the centuries and stuff, and now there's these texts, pieces of text that predated Jesus, including prophecies about him.
Yeah.
It was really of service to those who were interested in believing in our age.
It did, and really, and you know, there were the critics. I mean, after World War II, after World War I, those are just saying there is no God. I mean, full force, and then to have this come.
Or we don't know what the Bible text was, and well, you kind of get a sense of how much it had actually changed or really not.
Yeah. So like 1,000 years older text that we got. And it's what, 99%, and really, and again, it's interesting though how they'll talk about this or that. But when you really look at it, just not that much difference there. 1,000 years of transmission, and that again just shows how serious the scribes were in those methodologies. And then we talked about our Roman roads, going over that without the shipping, without the well-built Roman roads. We wouldn't have what was almost really sort of a subway of the ancient world. So there. And then, of course, we did have our different sects there. And I think we kind of hit most of those. We studied Lesson 11. I don't know if I copied something wrong or pasted something wrong, but Esther, in your book, it says 2. It should be 0. I think, though, there's some people arguing that something has. It's actually from Esther, but that should be 0. So you might want to make that change in your lesson 11. So, again, synagogue, Sanhedrin, the Essenes. And then the Herod's family, that a textbook, client king, and then so much of the world that Jesus was walking around with, that the massive... Masada, Herodium, the temple platform, Caesarea, and just several other buildings that Herod the Great. And of course, Herod's family involved Herod with the coming Messiah, John, his beheading, then the trial, and then... Paul's trial, all of that, Herod's family kind of involved there. And again, that, you know, isn't it striking that we call it Herod's temple? I mean, Herod was not a godly man, but it's described, that's how we describe it. Now, some will call it the second temple, so they don't have to call it Herod's. But, I mean, we'll call it Herod's temple. But, you know, what's interesting is that when Josephus is describing kind of the boundaries of the temple, he doesn't do this whole court and stuff. He does this interior area where Solomon's temple was. So that's very interesting, the days of Josephus, that, you know, they still, he thought of, no, not all of Herod's stuff is the temple area. It is where Solomon's temple was. You know, kind of one of the things that we kind of talked about there is in the days, you know, part of this fullness of time, we're saying this is just the right time for Jesus to come, for the gospel to be spread. And so that we say that for the Roman world, actually, well, I should have had these the other way there. That one should have been first. Said that by the 300 ADs kind of area, that about 10% of the Roman Empire was Christian. Now, there's a couple of different kind of calculations as to what the Roman Empire population was, but I chose about 50 million, so that would have said that by 300 AD, there was about 5 million Christians in the Roman Empire. So I think that's a pretty good argument there that this was the time. This was a time for that gospel spreading, for the people to be ready. For the gospel to be spread. And if we come to closer times, about 100 years ago, that it was about 35% of the world claimed to be Christian, and today it's about 32%, or over 2 billion people will say that they're Christians. So, and all of that kind of comes about, that spread of the gospel, that impact of what being a Christian is, or at least saying that you're a Christian, that 400 years of preparation kind of came. And, you know, as I kind of said here, I don't know how it impacted you when y'all read that, but I've been reading this book. And, you know, they've done a pretty good job, especially a good job, I thought, of kind of giving a feel of the times that we're kind of studying there as we're going into Jesus' time. And then they come to their last part of their book. And the one of the authors is agnostic. And so, you know, here he had gone through. I mean, he considered himself enough of an authority to write a book. Okay? I mean, I've just been cutting and cutting, cutting and pasting out of a bunch of books. This guy, I'm smart enough, I know enough about this time period, I'm going to write a book. And so here he comes and said, it could have all been so different. If just one tiny piece of the mosaic were missing, the whole complex pattern that enabled Jesus and his followers to live and teach as they did would have been gone. If there were no Hasmoneans, there would have been no Jewish state. If there was no Jewish Jesus in Galilee, if there was no Pompeii, Judea would not have been part of a larger Roman world. If there had been no Augusta, there would have been no orderly East in which Jesus could live and teach, and no easy access to the outside world as his faith expanded. Without Herod, there would have been no local stability, but also no popular discontent with the political situation, resulting in a supercharged messianic expectation. Without Tiberius, there would have been no continuation of the well-ordered system, the Principate, that's Augustus, but also no Syngius, no paranoia, no Pilate, no passion, no crucifixion there. So, you know, here he's saying, he's kind of laying out the argument, right? That this is the fullness of time. That's what we've kind of been talking. All of these things kind of have come together. That this has all been laid out. And so here he's just reading off all the things that we've spent 12 classes studying. So then he asks the thing and says, so, would Jesus have simply vanished into obscurity, his teachings not recorded or not preserved, perhaps even his name forgotten by history? Might one be permitted to imagine Jesus as an old and respected teacher whose then influential teachings and personal counsel might prevent the tragic events of 66 and 70 A.D.? What has this guy missed? He's missed God. And I mean, he says, hey, there is no God. I mean, as we go, I mean, how can you study the book of Daniel and the prophecies of Daniel and then lay out the 400 years that we've studied? Not 400 years of silence, but 400 years of Daniel speaking his prophecies. How can you go through that and say that these things that we've talked about, these things that we have charted, were chance? I mean, you could. But then to say, well, if Jesus had come and these things hadn't happened, you know, we'd have no Christianity today. I mean, would Jesus have, I mean, Jesus the Son of God, he's refused to admit that. And so he's gone through and studied all of this history and comes up with, oh, maybe the Jews wouldn't have revolted if Jesus had been around to teach them. I mean, he just misses it. And the sad thing is, a good part of the world today is agnostic, right? Or even worse, they'll say that they're Christians. They'll put a Christian moniker on there. But then you ask, well, is the Bible inspired? Can you trust the Bible? Is it historically accurate? And they'll say, no. And so they just throw away. Just as this agnostic threw away what we've just studied in the book of Daniel, what we've just studied about all this preparation, they're throwing it away. And just really denying the power of what God has been telling us. So I was really upset when I read that paragraph. I said, oh, book's not bad. You could tell that, you know, the agnostic was in there, but I read that, it just really kind of hit me hard. And now, the thing is, that's kind of interesting, I think it was that book or someone else read, you know, that list of people and stuff, if they hadn't touched Jesus' life, or if they hadn't been involved in that 400 years, do you think we would have cared what their names were? How many other Roman governors do you know? Why do we know? So, I mean, that's, you know, all of these people who touched people's life. We might know Herod the Great because of all that, whatever. But those Hasmoneans, Antiochus, all of that stuff, you know, it's that tying in of laying out God's plan that we kind of know. And so we get to Herod the Great, and so we come to the New Testament. And so there, you know, we open up with the Gospels. And so there's the wise men who have come from Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. That's it. And so that kind of finishes it. You made it. You've gone through 400 years.
I don't feel 400.
Well, you know, I was kind of going through the review and I said, boy, it seems like forever ago when we were looking at just how radically the world changed. Was that just September that we were talking about that? So anyway, kind of any other questions or kind of comments? Anything on this fullness? I mean, you know, how, like I was just thinking with this agnostic fellow, I mean, how do you think, kind of laying some of this out, how effective do you think he might be to listen to these things? We don't know how hard his heart is, but we know he's pretty stubborn in the head, right? For having kind of studied this. So, I mean, but, you know, and then the other thing is we have all these people that kind of say, hey, we're interested in Christianity, or, you know, they'll at least say, hey, I'm a Christian, but they haven't kind of studied through this or, you know, looked at these prophecies and stuff and kind of seen. So you kind of get into talking with them. There's a lot of probably other better places to kind of go. But, you know, here, you know, you can at least go to where this agnostic was. That he said, listen, you know, it is hard, if not impossible, to imagine Jesus accomplishing what Jesus accomplished if all these things weren't in place. Now, he refuses to say he's God, so he has him with an ending that we can't, whatever. But, you know, we would agree with him, right? That without these components in place, how well could Jesus have filled out the mission that he'd been given? But all of these things were put in place, and that's that 400 years. That was a purpose of giving that time for all the history to unfold so that these things could be put in place.
Hey, Daniel, what kind of add to this, you know, we've centered around that phrase in Galatians 4 about the fullness of the time. Now, all of these things are important to that, but also in the context of Galatians 3 and 4, there's the whole concept of God tutoring, you know, I think essentially mankind, that we can't be justified by law. We can't be justified on the basis of our unrighteousness. And all of that was important feeding into this.
Yes.
Not only has God prepared the world to bring Jesus into it, he's prepared the world to see they need him.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And it all goes together.
And I have not emphasized that, but at least I would say the Jewish teaching kind of touches on that a little bit, but not as well as that said.
So,
okay. There's CDs of the material. By some miracle, I actually got them burned at the end of the class. So get a copy of that. That has the PowerPoints, the lessons. Turn in your answer sheets, and I really appreciate all your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Not very well.